Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Today is the half moon day, December the 8th, and I was just reflecting that I think the last time I spent early December in the UK was 1993. So for one reason or another, I've always been in other countries, not that I'm trying to avoid the English winter and the this season. But one reason or another, I've always been away in Thailand or in the USA. And so this is the first opportunity I've had for a long, long time, 27 years since I've had the chance to be here in this period of early December, watching the light diminish each day and the kind of winter season coming in with the frost and foggy, colder weather. So it's this year, the pandemic has brought many difficulties and dangers and struggles, but one of the things on a personal level I've found, it's given me the chance to actually be here in one place and watch the seasons change from the winter into spring, spring to summer, summer to autumn, and now autumn into winter. And that's been a rare opportunity and a chance to get a direct feeling for the flow and change of the seasons, and to be paying close attention to that. Also, this the pandemic, as people know, it's continuing to have its impact. As the winter season comes on, the number of infections and deaths are steadily increasing. Now, here in the UK, more than 62,000 people have passed away from the coronavirus. In countries like Brazil, India, more than 100,000 people have passed away. In the USA, it's nearly 300,000 people have died from the COVID-19 infection. And so, and millions of people around the world suffering from the impact of the illness, being infected themselves or caring for people who are ill and looking after as family members or as doctors, nurses, social workers, and many, many varieties of care providers and support workers. And also, you know, family members who have simply had to live with those near and dear to them who are suffering from the illness and who have passed away from it. So these are challenging and impactful times. And just here in the sanctuary of Amaravati, we've managed to keep the virus on the outside so far. Touch wood, as far as I know, so far. But virtually every day, I'm reading out dedications for people who are either suffering from the illness or have passed away from it, or other diseases and causes. Our close friend of the Sangha, Mudita, Kun Mudita Surabhi Karnasutta, who was a devoted disciple of Lumpur Cha for more than 40 years. She just passed away in Thailand, lived in the area close to Chithurst. She bought a place down near Chithurst Monastery, West Sussex, moved out of London and had a place down there, restaurant and pub, the Hamilton Arms, where she was based for a long, long time. And is a very dedicated, committed member of the lay community and had a very good influence on the people around her. So she passed away from both pancreatic cancer and then the influence of COVID-19 just a couple of days ago, a few days ago. The impact of the illness, and then also the season. You know, as the days get shorter every day, the dawn gets later, the dark comes earlier each day, and as we sort of inch towards the winter solstice, there's and again, I think it's one of the reasons I have been reflecting on this is the first opportunity I've had for a long time in this country to really feel and to experience directly that. Shortening of the days, the coming on of the winter season. It's a little less impactful in California, where I lived for a long time. But you can see why the sort of on a very instinctual, natural level, there's a fear of winter, the things getting colder and darker, moving into the shadows of wintertime, days getting shorter, and how on a very ancient, basic level, there's a recoiling from that, a fear of that, and how when the solstice comes and we have the Christmas time and there's celebrations that we have at the turning of the year, the return of the light, that sense of the darkness has reached its limit and the light element reasserts itself. There's a rejoicing in that, a delighting in that. But we're not quite there yet. There's still an increasing of the dark in terms of the season. Another couple of weeks until the solstice arrives. So it does bring to mind that sense of how we relate to death and loss and the impact of the pandemic upon our lives here in this small community and in this country and around the world. Also, it brings to mind why this place is called Amaravati, the deathless realm, and how that reflection on deathlessness. How does that relate to the impact and the shocking and threatening presence of death and loss in our lives? It's very immediate and painful and tragic for many, many people. I was just seeing news reports, how some people have had many family members either infected with the virus or died from the virus. And how hard that is on the heart, what an impact that has upon the heart. And how does that relate, that kind of shock to the system and the presence of that? We have the principle, the idea of deathlessness, the counterpoint to that. And that's really why, the reason why Lumpur Sumedho chose the name for this monastery many, many years ago, when it was an idea in his mind and he moved towards establishing a place like this. It was the early 80s, and there was a lot of threat. There was right in the midst of the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union, and the talk of limited nuclear war in Europe was quite commonly in the news. And there were massive protests by many, many people, organized by groups like Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and so on. But the fear of death was very, very thick in the air, and a real show of terror and fear in the system that even if someone didn't deliberately start a nuclear war, things could be started by accident and we would be right in the middle of it here in Northern Europe. So one of the reasons why Lumpur Sumedho chose the name Amaravati, the deathless realm, was because of that fear of death, the density of the atmosphere, the thickness of the atmosphere on the emotional level in the human family. It's very strong, very present, very immediate. So he wanted to raise up deathlessness as a counterpoint and to help us to remember. And I was around at that time and here at Amaravati in those early years, and I remember Lumpur saying over and over again how this was important to remember that, to bring this to mind, that the mind and the heart are so easily overwhelmed by that you know, the fear of death and loss, and that the emotions can be deeply entangled in that, and so life can seem hopeless or despairing. So he wanted to sort of raise up the alternative, raise up the possibility or the actuality of deathlessness. And so, and he also had, he loved the name the name of Amaravati that he'd heard many years before. He first heard of the name Amaravati when he was at Suanmok Monastery, Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery in southern Thailand, and he'd first seen the replicas of the ancient friezes and images from the Amaravati Stupa, originally in southern India, what's now Andhra Pradesh. Actually, is its own state now, the new Amaravati is the capital of the new state down in southern India. And the Lumpur had seen these sculptures and heard the name Amaravati, where they were copied from, and that had stuck in his mind as a beautiful word, a beautiful way of referring to that principle of transcendence, the deathless realm. So I was reflecting on these themes recently, and I was remembering how the first person that I was with when they were dying was right here at Amaravati in the late 80s, and it was a woman from a Thai family, a Muslim Thai family, and she had become a very devoted student of Lumpur Sumato. She had come along with other friends in the early days of Chithurst and had become a very dedicated meditator and practitioner and developed a lot of faith in Buddha Dhamma. And she contracted cancer. She had breast cancer, I believe, and so she thought she was, and she was under the impression and had been told she didn't have long to live. And so she asked permission from her family if she could go into robes. And so she received that permission and then took the eight precepts with our community. And then so she in the early days of Chithurst, and she lived with us there for quite some time. And then her cancer went into remission. So she didn't pass away at that time, and so she ended up leaving the robes again, going back to lay life for a time. But then a few years later, the cancer returned, and once again she asked if she could, and it really looked like it was going to be terminal this time, very clearly. So she asked if she could come and rejoin the community. So her lay name was Amina Kulyanond, and her Pali name was Dasaniya, and so she was living in the nuns area, and people were helping to take care of her as she was ending her days. And we would, during those last weeks of her life, we would go and spend times just sitting in her room meditating with her, both the nuns and the monks. And her room became a sort of alternative shrine room. And we had a bit of a rota. I forget exactly how it was organized, but we would take it in turns and go and spend time with her. And it was a very, obviously she was in a dying process, so there was a lot of pain and difficulty for her. But also her room was always very peaceful and serene, and it was always very delightful to be there, to be sitting with her. And so it was, even though she was dying, there was also, along with that sadness of a life coming to an end, there was also a joyfulness and ease, because she was not sort of resenting that or resistant to the dying process, but really she was a very mature practitioner and had really sort of opened her heart to the ending of her life, as far as I could tell, and the conversations that I had with her. I wasn't a very senior monk at that time. I was just sort of part of the group, and so more often she would be talking with Lumpur Sumato, and that would be so where she was getting her instruction. But I was often along and there when she was getting some advice from Lungpo or just sitting in her room meditating. And the reason I brought it up this evening and was particularly because I was there when she died, and it was quite common that we thought the last moments were coming, and then people would gather around, and then she would her breath would get very, very shallow, and we would think, okay, today's the day, and then she would rally, she would recover, and then her strength would come back, and then we sort of gonna breathe a sigh of relief again, and she carried on, and that happened a few times over. And so this had been the case once more, and people really thought it was the end. A lot of friends of hers had come from London and gathered around and been with her through the late afternoon and evening, but she'd recovered and stabilized, and so people had gone away again. And I was in the in her room, and we're keeping like a 24-hour vigil with her at this time. So it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was there with Ajahn Chandapalo. He was a monk here at that time, myself, and a couple of the Sila Tara. I think the earlier Sister Chittapala, the first, not the German Chittapala, the Swiss Chittapala, was there in the room. And maybe one or two of the other nuns, I forget exactly. Maybe Ajahn Chandasiri was... Anyway, suffice to say, there was just a handful of us, maybe four or five of us in the room with her. And Sister Chittapala was holding her, and her breath was getting lighter and lighter. But it was 1 o'clock in the morning, so things were a bit quiet and sleepy. And so sitting there in the quiet of her room in the middle of the night, sitting on the floor with the Tan Chandapalo, and just hearing the sound of her breath. And the mind was very, very quiet, it was very energetic. Kind of the mind was a bit fuzzy from being in the middle of the night, but there was also an energy, a brightness in the room. And then suddenly Sister Chittapala said, "She's gone." And part of me had been expecting the moment of death. I'd never been with anyone when they died before. So part of me was thinking, oh, well, there'll be a kind of a sort of wave of energy through the room, or the curtains will ruffle, or something will happen. And I was completely unconsciously expecting something like that. And then there was nothing. There was Sister Chittapala said, "She's gone." And so then there was this moment where I thought, oh, I was expecting something. Strong intuition arose in my mind at that moment. Of course, nothing happened. nothing really happened, and it was a very impactful, insightful moment for me at that time, because it became really clear that, and it was a very, very much a non-rational, non-conceptual thought that. That sort of took shape in my mind. It's like it was like, well, the mind that's aware of the breath going in, the breath going out, it's just the same as the mind that knows a body being born and a body dying. What's the difference? A breath arises and passes away. A body arises and passes away. How could there be any difference? And it wasn't really a verbal thought. It was not like a sentence with a beginning and an end, but more just a direct, intuitive understanding that was the case. It was like there was nothing really arguable about it. It was just, oh, that's how it works, and it was really strikingly obvious. Of course, the mind that knows the body alive is just the same as the mind that knows the body dead. And again, without it being particularly rational, there was something that had the understanding that Sister Dasania's mind knows that just as it knew the body alive and the body breathing, there's a knowing of the body no longer breathing. I'm not saying I was having a kind of psychic ability to read her mind, but there was just that sense of, well, how could it be different? Is the mind watches an arising and passing away, and that also that quality of, well, nothing happened. There was really no change, and just like a breath comes in, a breath goes out, a day begins, a day ends, a body is born, a body dies. What could be different about that? So that was a very insightful moment for me, and then I really took that to heart, in the days following on from that, I was reflecting on that a lot, and just to see that kind of obviousness with which that took shape, how natural and obvious it was that, you know, the mind that knows birth is the mind that knows death. It knows a beginning, it knows an ending. But that which is knowing is totally independent of the beginnings and the endings. And so, as I was looking at that and exploring that, it took shape in my mind as how the sun relates to the earth, the world, and the planets that. And just as, say, it's natural for us to say the sun comes up in the morning, the sun rises in the east and crosses across the sky and then sets in the west. That because we live on the surface of the earth, then that's what we say. That's we're living here on the surface of the planet, so the sun rises and sets. But what that the insight that arose with Dasaniya's passing away, that when I reflected on that, was very much along the lines of, well, what does the sun know about it, the rising and setting of it? What does the sun know about its rising and setting? From the position of the sun, it's not rising and setting. If you take that image of the solar system with the sun, the great bright sun at the center, and then you have the little blue and green dot kind of spinning around off in the remoteness of space. Yeah, there's a spinning around of the world, and it's turning in its elliptical orbit. It's going in its orbit around the sun. But what does the sun know about its rising and setting? And that took shape as an image of, this is really what the heart of wisdom, that sort of the bright sun of wisdom, there at the center of this life, this heart, this mind, that's what this is really embodying. It's like when the mind is awake, when it's wise, when there is genuine mindfulness, heedfulness, then it knows the world. It knows the spinning of the world. And you can think of the world, you can spell it two different ways, W-O-R-L-D, the world, as we think of it usually, and the world, W-H-I-R-L-E-D, like that which is whirling around and spinning, the whirling world. When the heart embodies that quality of awakened wisdom, that bright, the great bright sun of wisdom, the heart of Dhamma itself, then the patterns of comings and goings, the risings and ceasings, the days and nights, gains and losses, and so forth, they're happening. They're known, but they're not disturbing or limiting to that quality of awakened awareness, that knowing at the center of things. And when we talk about the deathless, the quality of deathlessness. And I realize that all analogies or similes like this, they are kind of partially, they can only be partially true or partially relevant. But I feel it's not as though the sun is, yeah, but the sun is moving too. The sun is spinning around, and it's also the whole Milky Way, our galaxy is spinning around. That takes 22,000 years to rotate, and then everything is expanding from the Big Bang. So, you know, you can't say that the sun is still, but astronomy aside, just taking this as a symbol of our little solar system, that imagine taking the sun to be the fixed at the center, and then the planets to be revolving around that, just in for the purposes of this particular analogy, this particular image. I feel that's a really good way of symbolizing the nature of that deathless reality. That when we talk about deathlessness and that quality of transcendence, and say what this the aim of this monastery, Amaravati, this community is the realization of that deathless reality, to help the heart to awaken to its own nature as that bright sun, great bright sun of Dhamma at the very center. And then from that central awake position, as it were, then there can be the knowing of all of the different patterns of the world, the arisings and ceasings, the beginnings and endings of our life, the in-breath and the out-breath, days coming and going, feelings of pleasure and pain coming and going. So when we talk about the deathless or deathlessness, then as Lumpur Sumedho again would quote very, very often, probably still does, but in those days it was almost like the sort of national motto of Amaravati. It was that verse from the Dhammapada: mindfulness is the path to the deathless, heedlessness is the path to death. The mindful never die, the heedless are as if dead already. And so when we would reflect on that, or when Lumpur would quote that from the Dhammapada, then it's making clear, you know, when it says that the mindful never die, it doesn't mean that the bodies never die. it's not making that kind of assumption or declaration at all. Rather, it's saying that which is real, when there's genuine mindfulness, appamada, heedfulness, when the mind is fully awake and aware, then it's not identified with the all of the births and deaths, the comings and goings, the gains and losses. It's not. It's stopped attaching or identifying with the whirling world, the spinning world, and it's instead embodying that the great bright vast sun of Dhamma that's at the very center of this life of ours, the center of everything, that very quality of nature itself. And that's I feel it's a good principle to be recollecting at living here at Amaravati, and also those who are watching this the recording of this Dhamma talk outside the monastery and around the world, to be reflecting that on this, to really take that to heart. The geographical Amaravati is not the deathless realm on an absolute level, but it's a place that is established to encourage human beings to realize and to embody that deathless quality. But obviously it's not confined to this geographical spot, but rather if we take that verse from that teaching from the Dhammapada, it's pointing to the absolute importance of heedfulness, of that awakened awareness. Appamada amatabadang, mindfulness, heedfulness is the path to the deathless. Heedlessness is the path to death. The mindful never die, the heedless are as if dead already. So that then, what is it? Where does that fear come from? This instinctual recoiling from physical death, and also the other kinds of psychological, social, emotional deaths that we similarly recoil from and are intimidated by and sort of shocked and challenged by in our lives. But in that respect, you can hear a Dhamma talk like this or take that principle and say, oh yes, well I'll just embody that quality of awakened, aware wisdom. I'll just realize that that is the true nature of the mind, I'll take refuge in that awakened awareness, and then all suffering will come to an end. I'll no longer be threatened or afraid of those deaths and psychological and physical deaths and losses. You can't just take the idea and make the idea an actuality. The idea sort of points the way or indicates how things work, but it's not enough just to have the idea. It's not enough just to have the words sort of printed on a mug or on a t-shirt or sort of written in beautiful calligraphy up on your wall. The words are not enough. The words are indicating how the principle operates, but the words alone cannot really liberate. So in this respect, I feel it's really helpful to see what is it that sustains that fear and the kind of tangles that our hearts get into that make us so limited and burdened and stressed, so fearful in these lives of ours. There's a set of when the Buddha talks about this in many, many ways, and in the teachings, one of the forms that I think is very helpful to reflect on is what is called the eight worldly dhammas, the Lokiya dhamma, the eight sometimes known as the eight worldly winds, and these are ordered into four pairs. So these are, and I would say this is a good summary of where we get caught up and what the causes of these sort of these fears and stresses, these tensions of the heart. So these are probably very well known to most people who are here, who've seen and read about, heard about it over time. But I feel it's good to reflect on this. This is what, makes the attention, be distracted from that quality of awakened awareness, that clear, mindful, awake, aware quality, when the heart, the mind really knows the world and is unentangled in the world, unattached to it. What causes those habits of attachment and is then the cause of that fearfulness and stressfulness? These eight Lokiya Dhammas, you have the first two are gain and loss. That's the first pair. The second are fame and disrepute. The third pair is praise and criticism. And the last pair is pleasure and pain. The Buddha said the Buddha puts it as he starts to talk about this. He says these eight qualities, they revolve around the world, and the world revolves around them. That's an interesting way to reflect on it. So this is how much of our lives and our patterns of thinking, our emotional reactions are around exactly these qualities. Gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and criticism, and pleasure and pain. So if we take a snapshot of our lives, our days, just to see how much time and energy is spent getting concerned with these qualities. Probably for most of us here living at Amaravati, then fame is not a very attractive. Most of us are not particularly interested in being famous, but we do like to be, I would say most of us do like to be free of pain. We do like to be praised rather than criticized, most of us like to gain rather than lose in various different ways. I don't want to make assumptions about where people are at. But I feel that these are very helpful to look at and to see how, in the course of a day, how often we are finding ourselves, when we gain something or we get something. Oh yes, I got that. It's what a lovely place to, a nice room to live in, or a beautiful, beautifully cooked food, or have a really good friendship. And then when we experience loss, when that really delicious looking food, the last portion of it was taken by somebody else before we got to the place on the servery, or that good friend, that person who was a really good friend of yours last year, now that friendship is lost, something's gone sour between you, and that there's a sense of loss. Oh, I had such a good friendship, we had a good relationship, and now it's gone. The many and various different ways in our lives that we experience these dualities, and how we, the positive ones, or what you can think of as positive, so that the gain, fame, praise, and pleasure, to list the ones that are supposedly attractive, how when we experience those, the mind goes, yes, good, and we take ownership of that. There's a sense of inclining towards and taking hold. And then the ones that are more associated with difficulty and off-putting qualities, so loss, disrepute, having a bad reputation, being criticized, and pain. You know, just even saying the words, loss, disrepute, criticism, and pain. Just even saying the words, and I'm giving the talk. It just there's a sort of off-putting quality just to the words themselves. There's a recoiling. So just to look at our lives, to scan the memory of a day, or to look at the course of our experience during an average day. How much time and effort and energy do we spend trying to take hold of the pleasant and attractive ones, and trying to get away from the painful and off-putting difficult? These are, I'm not reading anybody's mind, I'm not sort of keeping track of what people do or how you spend your time, but rather just in living in community, watching my own mind and having conversations with people over and over and over again, it's so clear how much, these dualities dominate our lives, and how we keep, when there's a lack of mindfulness, a lack of appamada, there's pamada. When there's heedlessness, as the Buddha said, heedlessness is the path to death. We keep creating the causes for death, for psychological death. We keep looking for security in that which is that can't provide. So can't be stable, can't provide security. We keep looking for happiness in things that can't really provide that. We keep looking for a sense of value and solidity in things that can't provide it. So we keep getting disappointed. We get born into our friendships, our possessions, our living places, our physical body, our feelings of comfort. We get born into our positive mind states that come from meditation. Yes, I've really got it now. Yeah, that was a really good meditation. That was great. Yes. Yeah, all not to be too sort of sour or negative, but rather it's to recognize how strong those habits are when the mind goes, yes, this is great, this is fantastic, this is just what I wanted. You know, the encouragement is to notice that. And in exactly the same way, when we say, oh no, that's exactly what I didn't want. This is really, that's so painful. That was so good, now it's over. It used to be so nice, and now we've lost that. We can't do the chanting. Yeah, it's a real loss. Or we can't have people coming to visit, and people who are so devoted, so dedicated to the monastery, and they can't come in. It's painful to have the doors closed, to not allow people to be using the property. We can't use the retreat center. We haven't run any meditation retreats on site. We've done a certain amount of online teaching during this year, but haven't been able to have any on-site retreats at the retreat center. It's painful. All the more worldly and selfish losses. You know that. I really wanted that room, but I didn't get. I got this lousy room instead. I could have had that one. All right, I had that really good place last year, and now I'm stuck with this. So whether it, wherever it's coming from, to look at those, this is a bad, wrong, painful thing, that kind of psychological death or the ego death, as I like to call it, that comes with being criticized, being blamed, losing something that you thought that you had. Physical pain, just the aches and pains of the body as we all get older, and as the body is kind of stressed and strained through the ordinary flow of circumstance, just to notice, oh, not my left knee as well. Oh no. Oh no, not my back. Oh, what's happening to my eyes? I can't. Why is everything so blurry? Oh, not another pair of glasses. Oh no. Just to be seeing that right there, the mind has taken refuge in comfort, or has taken refuge in being able to see clearly, or has been taken refuge in having a particular room, or like today, it was the first day in a while where we could actually see the blue sky, and it was very foggy, misty, and all day for the last few days before this, and then, oh hooray, the sun's out, the sky is blue, great, and. Not to be too sour or kind of curmudgeonly, for those of you who know that sort of grumpy, a curmudgeon is a sort of grumpy old man, a curmudgeonly attitude, but to see the mind that goes, yes, this is good, then to notice, oh, here is the mind taking hold of what it, of a particular pattern of experience and calling it good, and that's a flavor, there's a texture to that yes-ness, and it's like this. And similarly, when the mind goes, oh no, not another injury, not another tweak in the body, or not another one of those, to notice, oh, here is the mind recoiling from the painful, the bitter, the difficult. This is when you've been criticized for something that you've done, or criticized for the way you talk, or the way you walk, or what you've, something that you've said that's upset somebody. To feel, okay, this is what criticism feels like. It's like this when there's a loss. When you find out that you've got a bad reputation, people don't respect you, or don't think that you're a very good monk, or a very good nun, or a very good person, or you don't do your job very well. That, you know, the last person who did that, they were actually much better at it. So even though we say, I'm not interested in fame, you know, that even with much more local things, fame is not just about having your face on a poster or being known around the world, but that just being someone who's got a good reputation for doing a job well, that we can relish in that. Someone says, "Oh, you're so good at this! This is fantastic! I'm really glad that you're the work monk or the work nun or the you really look after the stores so well." Oh, right there, that's what we mean by birth. The mind is born into that praise, born into that gain, born into that happy feeling. And if we're born into the pleasant side of it, then we're still attached to it when it turns into the painful side. So this is where I would say, in that analogy of the sun and the world, where the mind has left that central position and got born into the world, is tied to the risings and fallings, the beginnings and endings, the births and deaths. And so that centrality, that quality of stability and centrality is lost because of that birth. The mind is born into different states. It's a bhava. It's born into gain, so it's still holding that when it turns into a loss. It's born into praise, so it's still holding it when it turns into criticism. It's born into fame, and it's still holding it when it turns into disrepute. And it's born into pleasure, and it's still holding it when it turns into disrepute. Sometimes we think, well, I'll just, I'm sure there's a way you can attach to pleasure and success and gain and praise and then let go before it turns into its opposite. But I'd say you've got to be really quick on your feet to pull that off. And you know, if we're going to follow the advice of our teachers, the Buddha's teaching and the various elders who have taught over the centuries, then the wisdom of the ages tells us, yeah, you're not going to be able to do that. That's not the way that it works. Far better it is to recognize how that whole system works, and to learn not to be born to be refraining from that whole process of attaching to praise and gain and pleasure, and also it's not that we're just trying to flatten and make all of our experience a kind of uniform, bland, sort of evenness. It's not as though we're trying to sort of neutralize our emotions or neutralize and flatten our feelings, not at all. But rather, it's just training the heart not to be, taking refuge and being born into those states, either the pleasant or the painful. And that it's not a condemnation of pleasure and success and gain and so forth, but recognizing if you're looking for those sweet experiences to be something that can ultimately satisfy or liberate, then you're looking in the wrong place. This is a kind of expression that Lumpu Cha would use very, very often. So if you're looking for finality in that which is endless, you're going to be disappointed. If you're looking for security in that which is unstable, you have to be disappointed. If you're looking for happiness in something that cannot satisfy, necessarily you are going to be disappointed. There's no way around that. It's like that old story of the person who was on a street under a street lamp, where there's a little pool of light under a street lamp, and they're on their hands and knees looking around for something on the ground, and somebody comes up to them and says, what are you doing? And they said, I dropped my car keys. And they said, can I help you? And they said, well, where do you think you dropped them? He said, well, I dropped them over by my car, but this is where the light is, so this is where I'm looking for them, because this is where I can see. I said, well, that's really stupid. You're looking in a place where you're not going to find the keys, so you have to be disappointed. You can translate that into your own life in so many different ways, but we do that. Even though we think, well, that's ridiculous. If you dropped your car keys 50 yards away, you're not going to look in a different spot altogether. You think, well, that's a really stupid analogy. You know, who would do that? But if we look at our lives, if we look at the way that we operate, it's amazing how often we're under the street lamp looking for our keys where we didn't drop them. We're looking for happiness in things that can't satisfy. We're looking for security in things that are unstable. We keep doing that. Even though when you look at it, it's ridiculous, but we keep doing that. So the Buddha's advice is to reflect. And when we are experiencing gain, when things go well, when we're praised, when we have a good reputation, when people say admire us or value our skill with particular jobs around the monastery or our role in the family or in the world, in our different aspect, different living situation, different aspects of our lives, when we are feeling pleasure, like this is really good, just like this afternoon, it's a bright sunshine, and in the winter. This is one of the things about being in England in early December, the winter time, because the sun is so low, then it reflects off the the ripples on the pond in my garden for a long time during the afternoon, because the sun is low in the sky, so the light bounces off the water, and so there's this beautiful patterns of light and shade rippling across the walls and the ceiling of my kuti for a long time through the afternoon. So I can sit there and watch this beautiful movement of light and shadow, and the interesting the silhouettes of the cactus that's bounced on the ceiling and shimmering up and down the walls, and quite a light show, free light show in my kuti in the afternoon. Oh, this is so beautiful, this is so lovely. So it's delightful, it's beautiful. But if there's an investment in that, oh, this is great, I want to have this all the time. if the mind goes in that direction, then necessarily you're going to be disappointed. But if at that moment you go, well, this is delightful, this is beautiful, full stop, then if you recognize, well, this is just the delight of the movement of patterns of water and shadow and light that comes with an English winter, it's like this. And if the mind reflects in that way, it's not something that can be permanently satisfying, it's not something that is stable or predictable. It might never be experienced again. I might drop dead today, have an aneurysm, or just swallow a mouthful of tea or coffee, and it goes down the wrong way, suddenly it's all over, and then not that I'm expecting that, but who is? Maybe that's the last time that'll ever be experienced. But if the mind attaches to it and says, oh, I want to have this, how can I engineer things so I'm always here every December, early in December, every year, how can I fix it so that I always get this all the time? And so then the mind is hanging on to it. It's not actually there with the play of light on the eye and being perceived. It's planning for how I can keep this and make it happen next year and the year after. And so then the beauty of it is lost by the mind's grasping of it. And so the encouragement with those eight worldly dhammas, the Buddha says, if the mind is not obsessed with those, or taking refuge in gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and criticism, pleasure and pain, but it knows them as they are, knows them as changing patterns of experience, that these are anicca, they're in a state of transformation. They're not permanent, and they're dukkha, they can't fully satisfy, then they are understood as they are. And so then the heart does not get born into them. Now, when we talk about not being born, if the mind is conditioned to be attached to sort of thinking in worldly terms, it can sound quite nihilistic, like the sort of anti-life and a sort of a negation or a curmudgeonly attitude, like bah humbug. It's all dukkha, and just sort of switch off and ignore it all. But that is a nihilistic attitude, and it's not what is the essence of not being born. So I would say not being born is about the heart realizing its own nature as Dhamma. It's like being the great bright sun at the center of everything, embodying the Dhamma, being Dhamma, realizing that has always been the case. And it was only because of the habitual, distraction. And the word distraction literally means being pulled apart from the Latin roots of it. The mind is sort of the attention is pulled apart from that central quality of Dhamma. It's pulled into birth in liking and disliking, gaining and losing, being praised and being criticized, comfort and discomfort. When it's not born, then that's not a negation or a annihilation. It's not a nihilistic attitude. Rather, it's an embodiment of nature itself. It's really a way of talking about being Dhamma itself. The mind is able to to know those habits of grasping, those habits of identification. And when those habits of grasping are recognized, the different areas where the mind grasps, then, and we see, you know, so maybe you don't have a difficulty getting sort of reactive around pleasure and pain, but it's really difficult to deal with praise and criticism, particularly being criticized. Or for some people, being praised is more difficult to deal with than being criticized. For some people, it's like, oh, you're so wonderful, this is so great, I'm so happy you're around. Like, oh, don't say that. some of us are like that, it's much easier to fail than to succeed. Oh dear, I've done it, I've succeeded again. Oh, it's much more comfortable if I just make a mess of it all the time, then nobody expects anything of me. then if you do things well, then people just keep wanting you to do it again. And so it's easier to be a failure. So, but wherever we see the habits of mind and the habits of attachment, grasping, get to know that, get familiar with that. And then wherever those habits of grasping take shape, then that's the place to let go. And when we speak about ending birth or not being born again, even though the languaging of that can seem a bit sort of anti-life or nihilistic, if we reflect, is the last verse of the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness, it's speaking exactly about the habits of I would say is the different kinds of grasping that the mind gets caught into. The Buddha goes through them, at least in so one way of reading that final verse of the Buddha's words on loving kindness. The Buddha's going through each of the four different kinds of grasping and saying how when those are all let go of, when those habits of grasping are abandoned, then one is not born again into this world. It's the heart is freed from that distractive process, so that the different kinds of grasping, again we are sort of speaking about the kind of areas where we get caught up by not holding to fixed views, is talking about dittupadana, like the way the mind grasps an opinion, views and opinions. The pure-hearted one, you can look at that as relating to what's called silabat upadana, or the mind grasping conventions and forms, rituals, the standards that we're used to, the patterns of doing things, the conventions, social conventions that we live with. Having clarity of vision, that you can think of that as relating to Atavad upadana, clinging to the feelings of I and me and mine. Being freed from all sense desire relates to Karma upadana, the attachment to sense pleasure and clinging to sense pleasure. Being freed from all sense desire, one is not born again into this world. So that the encouragement of the teaching then is to recognize where each one of us, our own particular habits of attachment, where we go yes and no, to get to know those areas really directly, to feel them, to know them. Where do we get born? where does the heart have its familiar tracks of distraction? What are those channels of distraction, those pathways that the mind so easily runs down and gets born? Get to know them, get familiar with those, to see, you know, do you, maybe you're not too bothered by the pursuit of sense pleasure, but you really like your opinions, and your opinions are not really opinions, they're actually facts. You know, it's not an opinion, it's not an opinion, it's a truth. I know I'm right. This is true. Look at that feeling of rightness, and that sense. It's not an opinion, it's a fact, Ajahn. Look at that, feel that. or whether the mind is attached to the conventions that we have, the right way to do things, the wrong way to do things, how people should be, how they should act, how they shouldn't act, our traditions, our customs of Theravada Buddhism, and or the way things are done in England and my family or my in my way I like to do things. The story, our life story, the Atavada Upadana, my who I am. I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm old, I'm young, I'm tall, I'm short. Yeah, I'm an artist, I'm a banker, I'm a creative type, I'm a sensitive type, I'm a methodical type. Yeah, I'm a successful type, I'm a failure. All of those I ams, the way we create a story and make it so solid and real. I would say this is all to do with the Atavada Upadana. Again, these are not fixed or definitive ways of relating to these qualities, but just my suggestion of how we can look at it. But I'd say Atavada Upadana, it's not just the feeling of I am, but that taking the narrative, our own story, to be so real, so important. Yeah, my life, my saga. So not grasping the Atavada is just not being interested in your own story so much. Just looking at your life story just like anybody else's life story. Like, I think I was talking the other day about looking at gravestones, you know, the names on gravestones kind of worn away by the weather, and how, you know, you can hardly even make out some of the letters. Can't really read the name clearly. Like, why is your life so much more real and solid than the life that gravestone is indicating? And yeah, I love to reflect in that way. Like, my life is so important, and you know, me and my story and what I am. And then you know, there's a name on a grave. And so, why is this life more real or more important than the one marked by that piece of rock just put in the ground? How could it be more important? And then the areas where we grasp, that's where we let go. And then that in that moment of letting go, even if it's only known for a moment, pay attention to that in the meditation or during the course of a day when you recognize, oh, it's just liking, or it's just the sweetness of being praised, or it's just the painfulness of being criticized again. It's just bitter. It's just a bitter taste, that's all. Notice the quality of the heart when that moment of realization of, that's all, it's just this. You feel that. You really know that. I would say that's the experience of the deathless right there. Even if it's just so brief, so momentary that it is easily missed, and the mind jumps onto the next thing that I've got to do or the next impactful thing to deal with. Pay attention to those moments when the mind is not grasping, that the cessation of grasping is deathlessness. Bhava nirodho nibbanam, the cessation of grasping, of becoming, is nibbana, is the experience of deathlessness. In that moment of non-grasping, even though it seems like nothing special, at that moment I'd say the heart is embodying that great bright sun of Dhamma. It's embodying, actualizing its own nature, that the heart is being Dhamma at that moment. And it's nothing remarkable, but there's a feeling of simplicity, completeness, relief, ease. It's completely natural, completely ordinary, and delightful. So notice those moments of peacefulness, of clarity, simplicity, a total normality. Just to I'm not saying that's a full enlightenment experience, but rather I would say in that moment, notice what that's like when the heart is free of grasping, and then to reflect on those particular teachings. The cessation of grasping is deathlessness. So maybe when we use a word like deathless, it can seem a bit dramatic and something remote and far out and sort of strange. But I would suggest that that quality of the simplicity of the heart, that quality of natural ease that is present when the grasping stops, then right there, that's has the flavor of the deathless. That's the presence of the deathless is here when the grasping stops, when the mind is not born into things. Then, when that birth isn't there, then it's embodying its own quality as the Dhamma itself. It's being Dhamma itself. So I offer these thoughts for consideration today.